If we shut the windows here, will we be able to breathe? Because we'll have less noise.
Give it a try.
Yeah, let's give it a try. I don't know if there's a fan that we can turn on.
It's cold.
Okay, is that better?
Yeah. If we need air, we'll figure it out.
Okay. I think I'll stand just because there's more of you. It's a little. Will more people show up, or is this?
I think more, but yeah.
Okay.
And make sure the attendance sheet makes it to the back.
Oh, yeah.
What happened to the recording that we did the last time? Was it posted in the
studio? It was, yes.
Did it go up on YouTube or just posted?
I didn't notice on YouTube, but okay, I noticed in our non-Palo Alto.
Then it's on both. Okay, just curious. We're making an audio recording again today. Actually, can't do it on YouTube because there's no tube for it. We're making an audio recording. You're, of course, welcome to take notes and so on, but just so you know, it's my habit to do so. Last time when we were together, we did an overall summary of the eight limbs of Patanjali, which is so fundamental to the spiritual practice, and I introduced it at great length, so I don't need to do it here, and I'm sure it's the theme of everything we're doing. But what we decided we would do this time is the yamas and the niyamas, because that is what most people draw out of Patanjali, because it's the most practical application. Let me say it differently. It's the most easily accessible in terms of our everyday life. I believe last time we were together, I mentioned my friend who raised eight children on the basis of the yamas and the niyamas, because it was a way to build their character in such a way that they would be able to use it for the rest of their lives. When Swami Kriyananda was talking to us about education for life, one of the things he mentioned was that you should always keep in mind the inherent dignity of children. And when he was talking about art and dance and music especially, he said you want to teach them in such a way that even when they grow older, they will not be embarrassed about what they were asked to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, instead of just dressed up like a tomato and everybody thinks that they're so adorable for being a tomato. But if you're teaching them things like one of the songs that we teach our children, move all you mountains that stand in my way, and we have these motions that go with it, but you can sing that until the end of your life and you still recognize that there's an inherent power in it. It's not just childish. It has something really in it. When we were the founding child of our school, in a very real sense, was Gary McSweeney's son, Brian. There were one or two founding children, and he was one of them. Because Brian, who's now almost 30, grew up in this community. And Brian has always looked the same. His wife asked me what he was like as a child. He said, well, I said he had exactly the same head. It was just on a smaller body. This is an argument to say it. He has a very clean sort of features. But I was traveling with him in New Zealand, as it happened, with Brian and his wife, Rachel, and we taught the crowd, move all these mountains. Brian's about 6'3 now, and he's standing there doing all move all these mountains. All of a sudden, he just shrank in front of me to like being 5 years old and doing it just like this. But it was so interesting to me because it was just still true. Mm-hmm. You know, now he was a big man doing it just like this, but the fervor and the determination. It was just like he became five again, but it was all the same flow of energy. So the most useful things that we can find on the spiritual path, when you're learning to be yoga teachers, and you're learning it for many reasons, you know, actually teaching yoga postures is a dimension, I'm sure, of what is motivating you here. But the more we can take everything, and this is how Swami in the Raja Yoga Course teaches even yoga postures, that this is a useful life skill. And that even if you become paralyzed in bed and never can do another inverted pose in your life, nonetheless the principles that you learn can go all the way to the highest level, and even if they're not being used in the same way they're still equally useful to you. And coming back to the yamas and niyamas and my friend raising the children with this, it's like this is something that is always true and that I can always use. The yamas and the niyamas are one. The other that I particularly like myself is the eight manifestations of God, which is not what we're teaching, so I just reference that. But that also, which sounds very elevated, it is very elevated. How does God manifest in creation? Love, peace, joy, wisdom, sound, light, and energy. But if you get those eight concepts in your mind, you will realize that in every circumstance of your life, the question is, how do I be an instrument of God? Well, you manifest the way God manifests in this world, one of those eight manifestations, and one always applies. No matter where you are and what you're doing, there's always a way to solve the problem by choosing to be an instrument of one of those dimensions. Well, the yamas and the niyamas will explain to you any success or failure, any joy or sorrow, any disappointment or fulfillment. You can understand it through the yamas and the niyamas. And this is why when my friend would take her children there, we're fighting with each other, I'm unhappy with myself, I'm having a mood, she would take them to the refrigerator and they would look at these different qualities and then they would decide what was off. And what that does, you see, is it gives you a way to bring yourself back on course. Because so much of the time, it's just very hard to tell. What am I really unhappy about? What is the core issue here? Because the whole point of our lives, really, is we are moving from a position of confusion and delusion, and we are trying to get to a state of clarity and truth. I've defined this in other ways, and it's a very dynamic. These are really impressive.
I picked those just for you, Asha.
I'm extremely grateful. Well, let's see this. I'll give you the first one. It's always a matter of increasing awareness. I believe when I was here last time, I talked about this. It's always a matter of increasing awareness. What is it that gets us into trouble? What always gets us into trouble is that we didn't know something we should have known. We didn't know what we really felt. We didn't know what that person felt. We didn't know what the effect of our words were going to be. We didn't understand the implications of the actions. We didn't know the laws of physics. So we thought we could make it around that curve and the car wouldn't go off the road. Whatever it might be, there was somewhere that we weren't aware of something. And of course, ultimate awareness is self-realization. And when we get with the yamas and niyamas, what we're trying to do is we're trying to become aware of nuances of I would say, of two realities. One of them is what I'll just simply call divine law.
Can you guys see that color in that?
Yeah, I was thinking it wasn't the best. I started to change, but I kind of like the color. Anything but blue. I reached the point a little bit. I'm a little bored. I discovered that the dividing point, everything I have is blue. Version. I won't really go into extreme detail how far that goes, but almost everything I have is blue. But when I had to buy luggage recently, I pictured myself. I was traveling a lot then, in international airports, head to toe in blue with a blue purse, pushing blue luggage across the airport. I couldn't do it, I got purple. It was sort of like I realized that was the limit. Luggage was the limit. Anyway, we're trying to become aware of two realities. First is divine law. Now, in the Raja Yoga book, which you all may know that the Raja Yoga book is absolutely brilliant, but I just want to testify again, having reread these sections yesterday and today. Astonishing what Swamiji has been able to put into words. I've been studying that course. I first got that course in 1969, first version of that course, which was just pieces of paper. He revised it completely in 71 and 72, but that's what you're still reading. I don't think, as far as I know, I don't think he ever rewrote this after that. I was going to try to verify that. But what he's able to say in a sentence here and a sentence there and a paragraph is, I mean, all the years that I've studied this, when I was reading it this morning, I was just lost in admiration for what he's been able to put into words. But he has this concept of divine law, and the way divine law is generally interpreted in religion, which is distinct from spirituality, religion is what man has done with divine revelation. And it's not like it's evil, it's just what man has done with divine revelation. There was a joke. Satan was walking along the street with one of his lesser devils, just a junior devil. And the junior devil spied a great sage over there about to reach a state of enlightenment, and the junior devil suggested to the Satan himself that he ought to do something to interrupt what was about to happen over here. And Satan was quite relaxed about it, and the junior devil was extremely anxious, but nonetheless, the sage achieved his state of enlightenment, and the junior devil thought, Satan, you've missed such a great opportunity. No, he said, don't worry. He said, he's had his revelation, and now I'll organize it for him. So, we start with something that's true, and then we organize it, and then man has to put an explanation on it. So, revelation perceives the way things are. And then man puts words and explanations on that. So the phrase divine law is just simply saying this is the way things are. There's a law of gravity. In the physical plane, if I throw this pen in the air, it's going to hit the ground. And no matter how many times I throw it up, it's just going to keep hitting the ground. And you could say, God won't let me throw this pen into the air. And, you know, in a sense, you could say, depending on your concept of God, that he made the law of gravity. But what you're just really watching is just, this is the way it is. We're actually using a real candle inside this little thing. If I put my finger in there, it's really not a matter of opinion whether the flesh on my finger will burn. And it doesn't matter. This isn't because God hates me or loves me or anything like that. It's the way I'm made that fire affects flesh in a particular manner, that gravity affects physical objects in a particular way. So when we talk about divine law, we're just talking about the way we're made. And it's a law because everything plays together and this is the net result. And so what happens though is when we anthropomorphize the source of this and we have to have somebody who's made divine law and then we impose upon that our own very small consciousness, which has to box things down smaller and make them fit within the little sphere of our own understanding, and all of a sudden something is being done to us. And oftentimes, the way things are is not so obvious because it's just the cause and effect is not close enough together for us to understand how one thing causes another. Or we have a lack of awareness. You know, little children are like that. Honey, why doesn't Johnny want to come over and play? I don't know. I don't know why Johnny doesn't want to come over and play. So little Sam's mother calls Johnny's mother and says, because every time Johnny comes over there, Sam beats him up with the truck and he doesn't want to come over anymore. But little Sam says, what? You know, what? He doesn't see the cause and effect relationship. And so we think somebody's doing something to him. But regardless of whether we can see it or not, ignorance does not excuse it. No matter how angry we are about this thing always hitting the ground, it's just going to hit the ground every time. So when we hold certain attitudes, and when we follow those attitudes with the actions that are related to that, then it sets certain consequences in motion. And because the awareness we need to perceive the nature of divine law is very subtle, we keep reincarnating. It's as simple as that. Master said something that was so poignant. He said, we keep reincarnating, not because this world is totally disappointing, but because it's almost fulfilling. It's that little gap between what we imagine is possible and what we actually achieve, and that's what we keep trying to cross. If it were a complete chasm, we would recognize this simply can't be done. But it almost works. It's, you know, everything was fine except my one true love got in an automobile accident and died. Everything was fine except we only had daughters, we never had a son. Everything was fine, but I got caught in that dead-end job. If I could only, you know, be a painter this time, and. And Master said, Satan plants in our minds. And this conscious confusion, that's what Satan is, this conscious confusion that causes us to reason it out, that if I could just straighten out this last little piece, then everything would be fine. So we just keep trying again and again and again because we don't understand divine law. That it's never really going to get itself in order there. It's only ever going to get itself in order internally. And this is our increasing awareness. When we've tried to do market research for the sake of promoting Ananda, so that, you know, one, we will do our job and share Master's teachings, and two, so that we can continue to survive, there was a disciple of Ramakrishna, an Indian monk in Midian. This must have been around the early 1900s in America. He was assigned to New York City and came dutifully as a monk from India. And as the biographer I was reading delicately put it, he was not an inspired speaker. And no one came to his classes, but dutifully he would give them every week. You don't know whether to admire that or not. But anyway, he would do it because it was his to do. But in our reality, hoping rather to actually reach people, we've had to think, what is the unifying quality that draws people to Ananda? And it's never been possible to draw a demographic like you would draw it for, you know, who buys Teslas or something like that. You know? But there is one unifying characteristic as far as I can see, which is before you become interested in a path of self-realization, it must have crossed your mind that the source of my unhappiness has something to do with my inner reality and not only my outer reality. By no means has a person made that entire shift, because none among us have, but there's at least the beginning awareness that somehow it's my inner world that I need to work on. And whether that is merely I need to change my diet or exercise more, but some way there's a realization that my own actions will affect the way I feel inside, and that's the path that I'm on. Very often, people's ending up on a serious path of self-realization starts with some dietary change, because there's a realization of my actions and the way I feel. And then, how far does that go? And that's what we're working with. So we begin to try not merely to impose our will upon the world, but to actually ask the question, what is really happening here? Very interestingly, most of you, not all of you, but most of you, perhaps all of you, do come to a Sunday service at Ananda somewhere. And part of what we have in our Sunday service every week is the Festival of Light. And included in the Festival of Light is this little story about the bird, this little bird. And this little bird, it symbolizes the soul's long journey. And the bird goes through four stages, in fact, in the course of this little narrative, which we offer every week. And the narrative, it's very simple, I'm amazed how many times in my life I go to that little story of that little bird. Swamiji himself, just as a point of reference, he wrote the Festival of Light about 30 years ago, almost exactly 30 years ago, when he was in seclusion in Assisi, Italy. He felt there was a need, we needed some ritual at Ananda. So he wrote it just as it came to him, and he said he was at the point in the ceremony, and he said the phrase came to him, a fledgling bird. And his own response was, a fledgling bird? Like, what does that have to do with anything? But then he, things come to him rather than, he doesn't direct it, he receives it. But the fledgling bird goes through four stages, and the first stage is the mission. We are created by God, and our responsibility is to be fruitful and to multiply and to share with others all that we have. In other words, I am a part of a greater reality, and this will start talking with me, start with the hymn show in just a few moments. The same life force in me as in everyone else, and I can't get more by taking from you. Because when you're diminished, I am diminished, is the basic principle. So that's our mission. But what happens to us is we begin to feel what it's like to do it our way. And this is like your little baby that just always cooperates, who suddenly begins to have a will of his own or her own, and they discover they want it their way. The terrible twos. The child just learns to say no. Just says no. That's just simply it. No. And there you have it. And so we begin to enjoy our personal power, and we begin to think, and this is the rhetorical question in the festival, what else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? Which, of course, the answer to that is that's not wisdom. It's asked in that way that the deluded little bird is asking that question. But it feels so good. Must be the right thing, isn't it? So we go into the stage which is called in the festival. First stage is the mission. The second stage is the revolt. And what are we revolting against? We are in rebellion against divine law. We have been instructed that we are a part of all that is, but we rebel against it. And we get to experience the consequences of that. And in the festival it says, that bird's brief day was like eons of our time. And you just keep trying. You throw yourself. You know, there's a lot of doors in this room here. You could go out any of these doors, or you could probably smash your way out through the window. But this is a brick wall. But what we do is we just say, I'm going to exit through this brick wall. And we race at it and throw ourselves against it. And wow. And then we just get up and we do it again. And we're just absolutely convinced that this is the door. And the only thing is we haven't hit it hard enough. And then we fall here and we weep and we're broken and we rail at God. And then we get up and we throw ourselves at the wall again. Meanwhile, you know, we can at least get to the bathroom. Maybe the closet. And even out of the room if we stop doing this. But we're in rebellion. We're going to go through the brick wall. And nobody's going to tell me I can't. And that's the revolt. And it goes on for eons. And that is saying, I'm going to be happy on my terms in my way. And Satan keeps whispering in your ear, yes, of course you can. You just haven't tried hard enough. Get up and throw yourself ever harder toward that corner of the brick wall. That'll work. And so we just keep doing it. But then finally, after a time, this is what the festival part says, I love it. After a time, the tiny rebel surrendered. And surrendered to what? Surrendered to the fact that we do not create our own reality, but we are part of a greater reality and we must adjust to it. And then he enters the stage, not the stage of wisdom, but the stage which is called the quest. Because merely recognizing that we're wrong doesn't automatically tell us what's right. Especially not if habit is very strong. If we just for a really long time we've been drawn to the brick wall, it's really hard to even be interested in that door back there. Because this is blue and gorgeous and feels cool to the hand, and that's small and ugly, and who wants to go there? So we start questing with awareness to see what actually happens if. And you never learn anything until you move from the revolt to the quest. And then you start saying, and I love it because it's the same phrase. You can say, God, what are you doing to me? Or you can say, God, what are you doing to me? Completely different. One is the revolt and one is the quest. And so we are in the third stage, which is the quest, which is aware all of us are, because we're all experimenting to see what divine law actually is. And then the fourth stage is when we recognize that there is no separation, and therefore I and you and I and all reality are the same reality, and we live for the good of all. In the festival, it's described as the master's greater can no love be than this, speaking of an avatar, than from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of others. I mean, that's how we see it. We see that they've had to sacrifice in order to help us. When Swami Kriyananda said something to Anandamayi Ma about how unselfish she was in her giving, Anandamayi Ma looked at Swamiji and she said, "Oh, is that how you see it?" Just like that. Because for her, she didn't even know how to think about selfless, because that implied a self. There was no self or selfless. There was just all that is. And that's where we come to, where it looks like discipline. That's what with Swami Kriyananda, all the years that I knew him, it happened repeatedly for me. And it was always a very interesting lesson that I would watch him behave in an admirable way, and I would try to discipline myself to match that behavior. And, you know, much of the time I could, not always by any means, match the behavior. But I gradually realized that he wasn't disciplining himself at all. It was just the way he perceived. When I thanked him after some 30 years for the fact that even when I was in my 20s, and was intensely in my 20s in every way that that might imply, he never, not one time, never referenced my age. Or, I mean, what to speak of articulating it, he never responded to me as if. And I thanked him for that, because of course that gave me a certain timelessness in my own self-regard, as well as a certain confidence in my own potential. And he when I complimented him, when I thanked him, he accepted it graciously, but there, I knew him well enough to know there was a look in his eye that told me I hadn't quite got it right yet. Mm-hmm. And then he just said, after he accepted it, he said, "I never noticed." Mm-hmm. He said, "I never define people by the age of their physical bodies." He said, "The soul is ageless. It's just your consciousness I relate to. What difference does it make if you're 20 or 70? It's your consciousness, or 2 months. It's that your consciousness is what is real, even if your body's only infant. The consciousness is exactly the same. It just has to express through that limited vehicle." "I never noticed," he said. So here I am trying to give space to everybody's, you know, current state of chronological development. And he never even noticed the chronological pattern. You see how different that is? I mean, that's the redemption. That's not the quest or the kshatriya discipline. That's, okay, so what we're working with now is divine law. I thought I was going to say that we were working with two things. And now I really don't even know what the second one's going to be. Let's see, why is that divine law? No idea. Completely gone. So, I may put up one thing, which is divine law.
You said that
it's
divine law is two realities.
Uh-huh.
One would be the divine law.
And I'm a total blank on the other. I know it has something to do with our own relationship to it. I could make something up. That's odd, because it was quite very clear before. Just give me a second. Let me see if I can remember what it would be. I will put this, and maybe this is what I have in mind, which is simply our what would be the awareness of our own selves in relation to it. I would call it our self-realization. which is, there is divine law, and then there is our capacity to know it. And then, yes,
I think you might have been talking about just moving away from our delusions so that we could be more congruent with divine law.
Exactly, which is another way of saying self-realization, which is, yeah, I think that is exactly what I had. And I had a perfect phrase, which wasn't this one. That's what I've lost. But it is, divine law exists, and then there's our personal relationship to it is really what the second part is our personal relationship to divine law. Because this is not an abstract idea. This is an idea that every single day is affecting our happiness or lack of it. And self-realization is another word for awareness, which is why it's not the perfect word, but this is what we're looking for. Okay, do I have any questions or comments on that part? Yes, sorry.
I feel a little dumb. What is divine law?
Divine law is the way we are made. It's just the way God made us and the source of our suffering and the source of our happiness.
You are the source of our suffering.
No. Divine law, it defines and explains to us where happiness comes from and what causes suffering. I haven't articulated the yamas and the niyamas are an articulation of what divine law is.
Okay.
But divine law is everything. Divine law is throwing this up in the air and that it falls to the ground, that there's gravity in the physical body. It's just the way this world is made and how we have to conform ourselves to it. The reason I talked about the revolt and the quest is the revolt tells us that there is no external force that can't be overcome by my wanting it to be overcome. But divine law says, no, you're made a certain way. And I'm not talking about the heart and the lungs and the kidneys. Your consciousness is made in a certain way. And then we go on the quest to understand, who am I really? How am I really made? Because we're always making choices. I know I talked about this the last time I was here. Between what we think is going to give us more happiness and what we think is going to give us less suffering. And those are the two. Every single decision we make, regardless of how complicated, misguided, or inspired it is, it's always, we're always moving toward where we think is going to give us a greater happiness, and we're always moving away from what we think is going to cause us suffering. Very often, our choices are not guided by divine law, meaning we are not acting in accordance with where our true happiness comes from and what truly causes us suffering. Sometimes we're in active revolt, and sometimes we're just ignorant. But it's just quietly and steadily. A little child wants, I want chocolate cake for breakfast. And you say to the little child, honey, if you have chocolate cake for breakfast, you're not going to grow up strong. The child says, yes, I will. And that's it, you know. Child just says, yes, I will. And so we say, I want this and it's going to make me happy. And God whispers or vibrates or has examples, but we're not looking at them. Honey, if you keep eating that chocolate cake, you're not going to grow up strong. And we say, yes, I will. And we're just about that wise. But you can't make a healthy body out of chocolate cake. It's just not the way it is. You can't make a happy heart out of a certain kind of selfishness, and that's just the way it is. But what happens is, unlike the mother and the baby, we get to eat as much chocolate cake as we want, and we get to find out, ooh, did that work? Yeah?
So it seems like there's two things involved here, not just awareness or unawareness, but also choice. Because we can gradually come to awareness, but we're still often going to choose.
We're going to be compelled.
We're going to
by our vrittis.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, we're compelled. We may. So
we
the
may
difference.
Have some awareness that this is the way we need to go to the light.
Right, but it's better to have an idea of where you ought to go and not be able to do it.
Than
to have no awareness at all. See, between Swamiji and I was aware. Because I'd experienced it, that I needed to be entirely respectful and not bind people by chronological factors. And I was aware of that, And I was able, am able, for the most part, to just enjoy everybody's stage of development and not constantly make a point of it. Swami just perceived it. So he passed. I have to control my vrittis.
Yeah.
He didn't have to, because he didn't have any vrittis to compel him. Where I have lots of vrittis that compel me. Does that make sense? And that's very good a point, Shandana, because that's it. That's exactly it. It's your vrittis. Vrittis are, if you think of it, the river flowing and a whirlpool. And if you think of it as a physical river, the river is trying to get right to the sea, but instead of being able to have all its forces go to the sea, some of them spin over here because they've been caught by something and the energy drags them. So we're all going right to God, except that we're not. And we set out to go right for God, and we find ourselves here. We don't even know how we got there. Just because we were compelled by our vrittis. It's no joke. And between, you have to be very part of divine law, is you have to be self-aware enough to recognize, wow, I've got a lot of stuff to work out here. Yes.
I'm just curious if there's like, do you associate the vrittis with the energy of the chakras?
The vrittis are the energy of the chakras.
Okay.
The chakra is a wheel, and the vritti is the vritti is you have the whole chakra.
The way the energy is in chakra.
Well, a vritti is a whirlpool. Chakra means wheel, but you have many, many vrittis
right.
in each chakra. A chakra may represent a certain vibration of consciousness, and then you have many, many specific vrittis. A vritti of great attachment to this person, a vritti of great fear of this consequence, a vritti of profound disappointment over this, a vritti of incredible fulfillment in a certain way that causes you to keep reaching for it. All of those are vrittis because there's a whirlpool of energy. Yes.
So there's like little chakras within chakras kind of thing?
Like,
well, that's not really chakras within chakras, but like energetic movements. Like
yes, well, it's the whole direction of the chakra is a whole series of all these little vrittis. I mean, these are all just images, but this is the way to think about it.
Yeah.
When we speak of the vrittis in the chakras, we're talking about all the specific karmas.
Uh-huh.
The karma forms a vritti, an attachment, a longing, a desire. And yeah, just there's a point that where energy is circling around it because of whatever this point is. And you have zillions of these.
Mm-hmm.
And they lodge in the chakras.
So it's kind of like saying that the vrittis are the energy that the chakras are generating?
It's more like the chakras are the repository where the energy is stored.
Okay.
The chakra itself is, it's the vritti that is actually the energy. The chakras just, we speak of the energy in the chakras, but that energy is created by all the individual vrittis.
Okay.
And those individual vrittis are our individual actions, decisions, and attitudes. You know, if I want this and I don't get it. I mean, I can tune into my own, many of my vrittis, by no means all of them. Here's a difficult karma that I have with someone, and it has certain characteristics, and, you know, I can sense without remembering, actually, that, you know, what the past life story must be that caused this, and caused me to die angry, you know, and never get satisfaction. So I die with this anger against, it's an anger in principle, why didn't you respect me and give me my due, which is impersonal. I mean, I deserve to be respected, that's a vritti, and you should have respected me, and that's another vritti. Yes.
So does each chakra have its own kind of vrittis associated?
Oh, yes. If you think of the chakras, now there's so many ways to think of the chakras, this is just one.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of it from the base of the spine to the spiritual eye, you could say that each of those chakras represents a vibration of consciousness on the spectrum from total belief that the material world is the only reality to the absolute understanding that I am one with the infinite and that God dwells within me. Every time we make a decision, have a response or a reaction to life, we are affirming what we actually think is true. If so-and-so punches me, And I, my first thought is, I'm going to smash your face in. I believe that you are separate from me and that you've hurt me, and if I can hurt you, somehow that's going to make me feel better. I'll have more happiness and less suffering if I impose pain on you. And that's on the spectrum of this, the chakras. It's down here somewhere where matter is the only reality. Your body is physical, mine is physical, they're separate, therefore. Okay. Here, Christ Center, Jesus is dying on the cross. He looks at these folks who've done this thing to him. His thought is, oh my, my, this is bad karma for them. They're going to really have to suffer a lot because this was not a really smart thing for them to have done. So he prays, Father. And it's not even just saying, I forgive them. He's trying to draw the divine energy. Father, forgive them. They're just poor, misguided booble heads, you know. Don't punish them for this stupidity, because he's conscious of the fact that their suffering is the same as his. So we might not be able to go that far, but when somebody punches you and your response is, oh, you poor suffering soul, how can I help you? Then that's a different level of thinking, that I will be happier if I can help you rather than if I can hurt you. So all through all of our incarnations, every day, every minute, we're always affirming some level of reality. We can't fake it. It just is what it is. And it's like every time we do, we put a penny in the jar of the chakra that corresponds to it. Those are the vrittis. And over the course of an incarnation, if you could look at it, as people can, there's more pennies in different of the chakras. Your physical body dies, that whole system goes on, and the next body you have, that's where you start. Yes.
So then, at the lower chakras, you're more in, you know, earthly things, more of a chance of thinking of separation. Mm-hmm. As you get higher and higher, there's less chance of feeling this separation.
Yes.
I guess the goal is to get rid of the sense of separation down all the chakras.
And the way that is, and this is why I say there's many ways to look at it. Okay, what I just described is one. The other way is, and we'll come to this when we talk about Brahmacharya, which we will. It's all of the chakras also have a positive vibration. It's just a question of which way you're directing it. First chakra, as an example, the earth chakra, it's about feeling secure. Now, security is a fundamental human need. If we think about bazillions of things that we do that end up being pain-producing, many of them emanate from a lack of feeling secure. So we're always doing things trying to make ourselves secure. So the question is not whether we need the first chakra, which is a feeling of security, groundedness, solidity. It's where do we direct our energy in order to have that experience of security. Are we trying to get a lot of money? Are we trying to get a lot of power over people? Are we going to get a big house with big furniture and a big car that's really heavy? And look how secure I feel. Are we going to make a great big body so that I can beat up anybody who challenges me? I had this woman friend. She was much smaller than I. She drove this huge truck. She sort of said, I used to be a big warrior. She said, she just felt comfortable with this big truck, but it was clear to her also that God was trying to balance her, but she was resisting very strongly. Or do we realize that my security comes when I direct my energy upward and I am strongly rooted in divine law and in my relationship with God? And then the first chakra, instead of its energy draining out, as I put it, on a horizontal level. People talk about the chakras being blocked. It's more like they have holes in them. And so the energy goes to the first chakra, but instead of circulating nicely and drawing that energy up, it just shoots out, just drains. And we just keep seeking our security where we can't find it. And so therefore, we don't have the benefit of the power of the first chakra in an upward moving way. Okay, does that make sense? Okay. Esther?
Let me see how good it is. Can that same that you just said be applied also to the self-realization of ourselves with awareness? Meaning, when awareness starts to happen, it's like everything opens up.
Yeah.
And if you haven't had that awareness before, the opening is so an aha moment that all of a sudden I start feeling myself, give me more awareness.
Yes.
Give me more self-realization.
Yeah.
And if I apply that to Ananda, for example, classes or
yeah.
being with a specific people or surrounding yourself, there is such a thing of also being a scatter in that matter. Because
yes.
sometimes I don't know if I'm doing the right thing. I feel it's the right direction, but I also feel that, or I question myself, I don't know if I am or not, of am I scattering myself?
Well,
everything is good.
I think, and this, when we get to the yamas and the niyamas in a moment, but divine law says, the more awareness and understanding you have of higher realities, that is the real path to fulfillment. And there is, when you increase the flow of energy, when I ride this bicycle, this electric bicycle I was given as a present, I ride it a lot, and I'm a little older, and I'm not quite as good as I used to be with my body. It doesn't quite respond. It's still working really, really well, but not quite as well. And I have to keep that bicycle below a certain speed, even though it can really go fast, just because I can't manage that speed. And what happens to us when we start spiritually, we start moving faster. And there's two schools of thought about that. I've always been of the crash and burn school of thought. And others have always been, stay within your zone, don't risk. Personalities are different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so and then they can move forward within and others of us with a lot of Gemini and horoscope are different, that's
mm-hmm.
all.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really no rules.
Okay.
But what's happening is, it is natural, and I've had many people speak of it, and I've seen it myself. You're just escalating, and so everything is more.
Mm-hmm.
And then naturally, you just don't quite know what to do with it yet. And it's like everything else on the path. It's an art and a science. And you have to also, do I live alone, or are there consequences for other people? There's just a whole lot of questions which are all extremely individual.
Mm-hmm.
And just also just a matter of style. People go through the world differently. Mm-hmm. Some just reach the downhill and they just go as fast as they can, and others walk the bike down the hills.
Mm-hmm.
But you can get there, both of you can get there. And the one who's racing down the hill might never thrive walking the bike down the hill. They get so bored halfway down, they just sit down and find something else to do. It's all. But the other side you have to realize, and this, you didn't ask this, but it's also true, that desire which results in the dissolution of all desires is not, it's called a desireless desire. And there, when again, with Swami and Anandamayi, Swami said to Anandamayi Maha, she gave him so much attention and energy. She just singled him out of the whole crowd and kept him with her. He said, I feel selfish for taking so much of your time. She said, that which results in the dissolution of self cannot be selfish. So that which is there to dissolve your ego entirely, to pursue that wholeheartedly, even if others object, is not selfish. Because it's the end of that whole.
What I found for myself is the more I took in the teachings and just kind of exposed myself to, you know, everything that I was drawn to on this path, even though it seemed like a lot and, you know, much of it I didn't understand or I felt like I wasn't really taking in concretely at the beginning, you know, over time I began to understand it and make it more a part of myself, but also I feel like I got directed somehow. Like I was pushed in a way that made sense for me and that seems to have work, you know, actually work and be applicable in my day-to-day
Goswami puts that as energy has its own intelligence. Mm-hmm. And that the mere act of putting out energy gradually puts you in tune with greater wisdom. This goes back to the eight manifestations of God, one of which is energy, which is also called power. But if you just put out energy as wisely as you're capable, because wisdom is also one of the eight manifestations, it will teach you. Whereas if you put out no energy, then there's nothing, no change can happen because nothing is happening. Mm-hmm. So this is the crash and burn versus, it just, you know, I don't think crash and burn is such a good idea, but for me, I didn't have a lot of breaks. So once I started moving, I just moved until I hit the wall, which I did very regularly. Less so now, I'm a little more able to ride the bike, but I hit the wall a lot in my first 10, 15 years, quite a lot. But I preferred it. I didn't really have a choice, just my way. All right. I was thinking that we could take a short break, and then I'll come back and I'll do the actual yamas and the niyamas, okay? I don't know what your break system is, 5 minutes?
We'll take 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay.
This is the second person to be last night, so I was up in bed and I was feeling good in the video. Uh-huh. And I tuned it off because he was lying down next to me for him to sleep. And he says, like, no, can you lay down? And I like this woman. I'm like, really? Yeah. She takes 7 years. And I'm like, oh, okay. She's like, well, I mean, if you were very rich in the play because he wouldn't stop me. I don't know if you recall. But she just found the solution to me. She moved me in the back where I can stand up. And you didn't, but she did. And I'm like, okay, so can you just sit around? And I'm like, he wants. He helps me to go to sleep.
Yeah.
So that you said right now about no age.
Yeah.
It surprised me that he saw you as
7 years old. Oh, very good. I consider that a huge compliment. There was a little girl. I've had this in my book about Swami. When Swami came to visit the school, she was about 8, and she must have felt that about him. And she looked, she finally walked up to him like, and said, "How old are you anyway?" And then he said, "I'll put it to you like this: when you were an old woman, I was a little boy." And then she got it.
It's funny because he didn't even wonder why. I think she said it, you just said it.
Yes, because she was like, oh, okay. I'll take it.
About the chakras again.
Mm-hmm. It's very, you know, if you want to, on YouTube, the Asha YouTube channel, there's a 4-part series about the chakras, which apparently is quite good. But a lot of people really comment.
I've taken classes where they work with like pulling energy out of chakras and healing individually each chakra and doing meditations around your
I did just go with my nose while she wasn't talking. Walk out of this room and come back in this room. I did too. I read that book.
Just go through the yamas and the niyamas. As you all well know, this is an excellent book. And there's chapters in here about the yamas and the niyamas, but I'm not going to worry about covering everything. Also, in this book, his section about the yamas and the niyamas is also just brilliant. It's all very, Swamiji's way of writing is very seminal, is the word he uses. He doesn't try to take every idea and stretch it out as far as it can be stretched. And every he never wastes words. So you can, whenever I start yellow highlighting, I always laugh when I look back because I'm basically yellow highlighting. So it's meaningful to me, so I still just keep doing it. I've been doing it forever. It's just absurd. But because he doesn't waste words, if the words, if the sentence is not really, really contributing, he doesn't include it. But that means, it's like he goes across the top of the mountain, and he explains to you how he got there. It's not entirely, he said Master just skipped across without any explanation. Mm-hmm. You know, and Swamiji, in editing Master's writings, had to give us, as he put it, a few more logical bridges over the intuitive leaps. But there's still a lot of intuitive leaps in what Swami does, which is why I can read this again after having read it first when I was 22 years old and still feel like I've never read this before, really almost literally, because there's so much intuition in there that when your intuition changes, you just read exactly the same words different. It's scripture. That's the only word for it. Okay. So we're working with yamas and niyamas, which are considered to be either the do's and don'ts of yoga. And there's, as there is in all of the Patanjali system, there's something really subtle. Yama means to control. Niyama is the opposite. When you put ni in front of something, it means the opposite. It means you stop controlling. And this is always a little bit hard to get your mind around, but there's an extremely profound spiritual principle involved in this. Our fundamental nature is perfect in divinity. And if we just stop blocking our perception of that fundamental nature, the fundamental nature will express itself. So the yamas are all put in the negative, which is a little confusing. But the point is, what we have to control is we have to control the falseness. We don't have to create the truth. The first one is called nonviolence, which is a word that we were more used to hearing. So the word non makes sense in that context. It's called ahimsa. And for many reasons, ahimsa is better known. We have to control our tendency toward violence. Now, violence isn't just breaking someone's face with your fist. It's in any way attempting to impose your own reality upon anyone else's reality, to do violence to their own divine expression. I'm going to list them all out. The second is non-lying, which I don't have the Sanskrit words for all these. I don't even know them. Another way of just saying it is truthfulness. And what we're talking about, I'm going to come back in more detail, what we're talking about is the truth is our divine nature. But we're always lying about our truth. We're always acting as if we are limited in our nature. If we simply stopped affirming the illusion, the delusion, then truth would always be there. And truthfulness is much more than just the facts of a situation. It's the underlying divine reality of it. The third one is it's called non-stealing or non-avarice, non-covet, non. I like covetousness. It's an odd word. Non-covetousness. And sometimes we call it non-avarice, which is also, you can say, non-greed. But all of these, you know, are just an attempt to put into English what we're trying to say. Coveting is to desire something that is not yours by right. And so it's a very subtle. Avarice and greed would be, God gives you what belongs to you, but I want something else. And we'll come back to that in another moment. And then non-sensuality, which is also called, Swami's explanation of non-sensuality is just stunningly brilliant, which is also brahmacharya. Brahmacharya literally means flowing with Brahma. Brahma means being the divine. We tend to think of non-sensuality as, you know, a very restrictive and backward thinking, but the truth of our nature is that we are one with the infinite, and if we flow with infinite force, there's no sense of denial. And this is, again, where we have to stop controlling our impulse to go away from our true nature and just allow our true nature to express itself. We have to flow with Brahma by acting, by restraining our inclination to follow our senses and think, and let our senses dictate to us what we think is the truth. And of course, this is the word compelled. We are physically compelled in countless ways. Physically compelled, we're cold, we have sexual desires, we're hungry. All of these things that compel us, we're compelled by our senses. We smell something we don't want to smell, all of these different ways. And then the last tier, number five, of the things that we have to control, non-acceptance. Some wrong translations call this non-acceptance of gifts, but Swamiji says that it just doesn't make any sense to say that. And non-acceptance is, in other words, also to be non-attached, to control attachment. Covetousness is to covetousness. Coveting is to desire something that doesn't belong to you. Non-attachment, non-acceptance, is not to accept as your true nature even that which has been given to you. Meaning, here you are in your physical body, and you think that this physical body is me. And there's no question of coveting, it's just what we have. But do we accept it as our truth, or do we just say that it's here, but it's not me? What do we identify with? What we call non-attached is to say that, I mean, if you're completely non-attached, well, if this body is hurt, if this body is threatened, if this body dies, it's very casual because it was never me. A friend of mine who had a very serious illness and just got all the way to the point where he really thought he was going to die and so did everyone else. And he didn't. He came back and he's been going on for several years. He said it took him more than a year to come back. Mm. Not physically, but he just went so far out of accepting that this was his reality that when it was given back to him, it took him time to just find his way again. Back into this world, it can make you freer, or it can, you know, there's a lot of aspects to it. Okay, so these are the yamas, and I'll do the niyamas in just a moment. Nonviolence ahimsa is well known in our time because of Gandhi. He made such a gigantic point of it, and Swamiji said the only misunderstanding that has been put forth from that context is that we think that ahimsa, he said, is the last resort of weakness. He said, whereas ahimsa is absolutely the most powerful way that you can neutralize animosity and violence and difficulty in your life. He said, because the perfect practice of ahimsa, of nonviolence, is that no dissonance can arise in your presence, because your commitment and your vibration of absolute harmony and peace is so strong that it dominates anyone else's inclination to violence. And the way Swami put it is, you convert your enemies into friends. And what greater victory can there be than to even altogether to neutralize that? I heard a quote from Gandhi, which I love. Gandhi says, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. It's really just a beautiful way to say it. But what is so important about nonviolence is because this is a relative world, meaning that you can't have absolute values here. You can't never do anything to anyone, because it's just, things don't work out that way here. So what we're really talking about, and it's such a powerful concept, is an attitude of harmlessness. I think it's just such a beautiful way to say it. It's an attitude of harmlessness. I remember I had an encounter, this was many years ago, and I was trying to be helpful to someone, and I wasn't very sensitive in my effort. I was well-intended, but I wasn't sensitive. And so I ended up antagonizing somebody I was trying to serve, and I antagonized him to such an extent that he went to Swami and told Swamiji what a chump I was and how could he let me out on the street without a leash. And because this man was not so good at non-lying, in the sense of not deliberately telling untruths, but his capacity to perceive things as they actually were outside of the filter of his own likes and dislikes. He did not have this one, which I'll speak a little more about. So what he presented to Swamiji was so distorted by his understanding of reality that it bore no resemblance to what actually happened. Mm-hmm. I have, unfortunately, a very astute memory. So Swamiji sort of told me what had been reported to him, and I said, of course, that isn't what happened. And Swami said, I understand that. But he also said to me, you have to pay attention not only to what you intend, but also how it will be perceived. And because this is moving us into non-lying, I'll come to here. Non-lying is more than just talking about the facts. Because facts are just facts. The fact is so-and-so may be an egregious liar. The fact is somebody may be a very unkind person. But the truth is that the same divine spirit exists in that person as exists in everyone. So truth is always, the way Swami puts it, is always beneficial. Now, that doesn't mean that truth is always nice. The truth may not always be pleasing to someone, but it's always in the end beneficial. And sometimes truth has to be spoken with a great deal of force. Sometimes truth has to be acted out with a great deal of force. Non-lying. You know, Gandhi chose a non-violent approach to getting India liberated, but non-violence would not have worked against Hitler because it just simply wouldn't have worked. In fact, Master himself said that the reason that Gandhi was successful against the British is because the British culture has such a profound sense of fair play. It's a very, very deep quality in the British. And so for the British to go with armed against unarmed people was so contrary to the rules of the game that it became unbearable. And that's how he won. But he said if they had gone against the Russians or the Chinese, I'm not trying to point fingers, but just where the whole value system is different, where, you know, power or cunning, and maybe I don't have to give it cultural names, but where there's a different value system, where the concept of fair play doesn't hold the culture to such an extent. As Master said, you could practice ahimsa in front of a tiger, but you may end up practicing it inside the tiger. They would just look at you and call you a fool and just mow you down, and that would be the end of the story. So the truth of a situation, however, still, there's a reality that we're working with. Non-lying is the ability to put aside our likes and dislikes, to put aside our fears, to put aside our prejudices, and simply relate to things as they are. And as they are is not always, you know, beautiful and kind and lovely, even looking at ourselves or looking at others, but the truth is always liberating and always helpful. In back to in this particular situation, you know, Swami just said to me, you have to pay attention to people's readiness to hear what you have to say. And in that sense, I was not practicing ahimsa because what I was saying was so outside of what that individual wanted to hear that it was harmful to them. It, what it did instead was it just infuriated him. It made him go seek recourse in a higher court. You know, it was pointless on my part. And I wasn't adhering to truth because what I was saying wasn't beneficial. It was absolutely factual, It was a complete, accurate analysis of the individual's weaknesses and what he needed to do, but it was absolutely outside of these realities. The most powerful practice of Ahimsa, as I was saying, is an attitude of harmlessness. Very deep in your heart, you have to look that way. Because it's not so much that we wish people ill, is that we desire what we want regardless of how they feel. And sometimes that's just where we are. And one of the aspects that Swami writes about so beautifully in here is that we can't do violence to our own nature either. Which is, and this comes into non-lying. With non-lying, we have to be truthful. And truthfulness is not wishful thinking. Truthfulness is recognizing this is the ideal, and this is where I am in relationship to it. And not allowing our likes and dislikes to prejudice us against merely accepting what is. So the truth of the matter is, I better not go anywhere near this person because I do not have an attitude of harmlessness toward them, and I have to accept that that's how I feel, and so I need to work truthfully and beneficially around who and what I really am. But if, again, taking this back to my friend in the refrigerator, if we start looking at the dissonances that we feel inwardly and the dissonances we feel with other people, you ask yourself, do I really have an attitude of harmlessness toward this person? Or is there just a little bit in me that wants them to lose? When we have this very contentious event at Ananda Village in the early 80s, we tried to incorporate Ananda Village as a California city. This is a whole very interesting story which is told in my book about Swami Kriyananda. Because a municipality in California has land use control, it can set its own zoning, which is very much something we wanted. And wacky as it was not, it was actually a feasible idea. We lost, but it was a good idea. If we could have made Ananda town, we could have controlled all of our land and done what we felt we needed to do with it. And we would have done it respectfully and honorably. Wouldn't have misused the power, it just would have. Nobody else actually understands what we're doing, and trying to make conform their rules has just always been a nightmare. But we lost. We lost colossally, fantastically. Everybody opposed us except us. And in the end, we were in the largest halls in the county, 800 people, a big hearing that went till 2 in the morning. It's a great story. It's all told in there. And our civil rights were abused, and we lost, but we were going to go and appeal, and we were on it. But then, for various reasons, Swamiji decided that wasn't really a good plan, so we just dropped it. I worked on it for 18 months with everything I had, and then from like this, it ended. And it was very interesting to me, because I got to practice with both non-attachment and ahimsa. Ahimsa was really what I ended up thinking about the most. I really didn't mind losing, especially because Swamiji had very cogent reasons for accepting that we had lost. I really hated that they won, though. It was really interesting to me. I really wanted them to lose. Of course, the two were incompatible, but it really irked me that they got their way. I mean, that's really not admirable. I was saying this last night in a webinar. And then just interestingly, just to finish the story, just very, very soon after that, I became very sick. Mm. And I don't get sick very often, and I rarely have a fever. In fact, actually, I only have 2 instances, and both of them were related, mm-hmm. like this. I got a really high fever for a few days. And it was like just all that anger at those people just literally set my body on fire. Wow. But it also burned it out. And as soon as the fever was over, you know, just like it's not worth it to me. But we carry these little bits of jealousies and envies and why don't you treat me right? And very simple, as Swamiji said, the person you're projecting that gets a little of it, but you get all of it. And when you're holding those dissonances in your mind, then the world responds. perfect practice of ahimsa is that no disharmony can arise in your presence. Patanjali puts it, you can be in the presence of wild animals and they will be peaceful to you. You know the story of Master rescuing the cows from the tiger, and just the tiger just rolling over on its stomach and behaving like a kitten with him, because of his consciousness was so perfect in his relationship to it that the animal itself wasn't able to exude any violent qualities toward him. Swamiji, on several occasions, people, he's had a lot of people criticize him in his life, and some of our neighbors, when I see that Kriyananda, I'm really going to tell him off. So Swami was in a coffee shop, and there was this guy who said that, so Swami goes over, and he sits down, and he says, I understand you have something to say to me. And the man was just harmonious and kind. Swami just says, that's always happened to him. People will say that they're good, but when he comes with this attitude of complete, well, also truthfulness. Mm-hmm. Just whatever you think you're doing, I know who you really are. Mm-hmm. And everything is different. So think about it in your life when things are not happening as they ought to. Now, covetousness. Covetousness. Anyway.
I saw it in the book. It's COVETOUS.
Covetous, that's right. Yeah, curious. Yes. That's what I kept having. Yeah. I've settled it now. Covetous. TOUS. That's it exactly. Funny how the mind just loses pieces. Coveting, this is like, it's so constant and it's so subtle within us. And the culture we live in is magnificently designed for delusion. Just magnificent. You can hardly just take a turn without, you know, I on my emails, because I, every so often, I order online, so everybody has my email address, and fortunately my junk filter works really great. But anyway, I always have to look, at least glance through the junk. It's all very well organized, but I have to look at it. Talbot's is giving me 20% off today. Kohl's is having a sale until 9 o'clock. Ann Taylor's, you know, it's just like, there it all is. Every one of it, every day. And I just look at it, 40% off on a whole bunch of stuff I don't need or want. You know? But it's 40% off. And you just watch yourself.
Yeah.
Just go toward it. How many times have you walked into the market to get milk and walked out with 3-4 bags of stuff? I mean, then maybe groceries you do need, but you go into any store at all, and invariably you walk out with something that you didn't know you needed until you saw it. So that's just on the level of materialism and overspending. But there's a whole other level where, and this is where the yamas and the niyamas balance, the pair to non-covetousness is contentment, which was the first of the neons, which is, I'm never really feeling complete in myself. Because there's always something that hasn't already come to me that I wish it would come to me. Maybe it's, I wish that my husband would respond to me differently than he does. I wish that my sister would call more often. You know, I wish that my mother were still alive. Just that something I don't have that I want. And when we become sensitively aware of what's moving us inside, it's quite disconcerting to realize how rarely we actually rest and how constantly. I mean, you might not think of yourself as a greedy or a materialistic person. You know, but nonetheless, there's just always this, if only I had, just pushing against, instead of what comes of itself, whatever is meant to be mine, I will have, you know, everything that I could possibly want or need is mine already. This is again why it's put backwards. If we just can control this impulse to always be trying to get something that isn't in the natural flow, you know, that people, this becomes, nowadays it's become really, it's become a named psychological syndrome, which is overspending, compulsive spending, where people just constantly need to acquire something else. And there's also this, people become greedy for experiences and for stimulation. I'm in this constant battle with noise on the planet, and with, especially at the YMCA where I exercise, I'm in a constant battle with the necessity that people seem to feel there to be constantly disturbing their inner peace with some rhythmic annoyance of one kind or another, that we can't just go and be inside ourselves. We have to always be pushing. Daniel Brinkley, who did a lot of work, has done a lot of work with hospice. He describes the Western attitude as being, we have what he calls life greed. Yes, when the end of life is coming, we instead of just accepting that the end of life is coming, we become really greedy to have a little bit more. His statistics, he had two statistics which I understand are valid. One is, first, there is no crisis of medical care in the country because 70 cents of every dollar spent on medical care is spent in the last 6 months of a person's life. And it extends a person's life an average of 21 days. And if we simply stopped trying to extend everybody's life 3 more weeks, then all of the insurance and the finances and the money of medical care would all balance itself back. And then he adds, and those 21 days will be the most physically miserable you will spend, because the body is trying to die, and we're, by all these, you know, draconian methods, are trying to keep you in it, when in fact it just needs to go. But that's an extreme example. And the reason we have that kind of greed is because we're lying all the time. We can't understand that reality is life and death. And because we're not practicing down here non-attachment. You know, we're so deeply committed to this one body that we're in that what I have I must keep. I have an ironic attitude toward what, well, in the Bhagavad Gita, it says, what is day to the worldly man is night to the yogi. What is night to the worldly man is day to the yogi. But that, by worldly, what that means is the one whose life is defined externally and who's defined internally. Everybody thinks that the very best thing at the end of your life is to be surrounded by, you know, to be in your own home with all your own beautiful things and all of the people who love you around, and every single thing that you have been defined by this whole lifetime needs to still be there at the last moment, you know, and that you have to just be pried away from it. And this is considered to be really positive. Whereas in the traditional Indian reality, which is not really followed but was, the last stage of life is sannyas. And in that, you simply, at a certain point, you recognize that it's over. And you walk away. In the Mahabharata, there's a certain point where Yudhishthira and Arjuna and his brothers, and well, before that, his mother, and all of the elder group after the war is over, they just say, it's over for us. And they just go off into the woods. And they don't go off into the iceberg to die. They just go off into the woods to focus on the fact that what's coming next, instead of focusing on what I've had and trying to hold on to it to the last possible second. You know, getting our face lifted and continuing to tie up. Or just all those things, which is a complete, non-acceptance in the wrong way, but just that non-truthfulness is what we're dealing with. So coveting is believing that I must have anything that I don't already have, that I know better than God. Now, don't misunderstand, when we come to brahmacharya, I'll talk about this a little bit. Power is also an aspect of the divine, and we need to have power within us, and we may feel that the truth of the situation demands that I focus my power on creating something that needs to be created. So don't think that non-covetousness is passive or weak or tamasic or an excuse for just having nothing. When you see people who just have nothing. I had a funny experience when I was about 50. I have a pale complexion and pale features. And when I was about 50, a friend of mine persuaded me that I absolutely had to start wearing makeup.
And I just needed to pay more attention.
And I kept protesting. And then she pointed out to me, there was this particular woman who periodically came into our world. The person, for many reasons, was not attractive. But she, my friend kept saying to me, that's what it looks like when you just give up, is how she put it. When you're not putting out enough, maybe, no, why am I saying this? Oh, yes, when you're not putting out enough energy. So non-covetousness and contentment is not that you just don't give a damn anymore. It's that you are very dynamically aware of what you really are, and this is where they all go together. You know, you're standing in truth, but you're not trying to make it different. But even if you're ever going to affect things as they are, you have to first. If you're going to change things as they need to be changed, you have to see what is really happening. You have to be truthfully understand what is really happening. I was using the example of the makeup and so on like that. I was just beginning, you know, video and so on was beginning and so on. And she said, look, you know, your face washes out. You've got to do something about this. This is just simply the way it is. And so it's not as if we just do nothing. But when you balance it with truthfulness, part of truthfulness is to recognize, you know, this is something that I need to put my energy into, but not because I feel discontent. That's what I'm trying to say. Not because I'm trying to look 30 when I'm 50. It's, you know, nothing like that. But this is the right way to be. I'm at peace in my own heart, and then when you're at peace in your own heart, you can really tell what is meant to be yours. That's what I'm trying to get to. When we're all rattled, we can't tell. We pursue the wrong thing, we don't go after what we should go after because we're always grasping. And you must understand, absolutely everything in this culture works against it. Absolutely everything. You get as much detrimental energy. You can't breathe in this culture without being absolutely assaulted by delusion in this one. It's just stunning, absolutely stunning. When I first went off to the ashram, we were way up in the mountains, we were living all by ourselves. Oh my God, what a relief. I mean, now you can't, even no matter where you go, because of Wi-Fi and internet and computers, you have to. Then we had no televisions, no electricity, no radios, nothing, absolutely zero, just out in nature. And it was, to not be bombarded, oh my God, what freedom. But, so here you have to, and this brings us to non-sensuality, which is to conserve your energy, to hold your energy and direct your energy. People, non-sensuality is often, brahmacharya often is described as refraining from sexual activity, which as Swami says in his book very nicely, is not a very attractive thought for most people. You know, it's a frightening thought for many people. But what we're dealing with is being compelled by physical realities. And what we're trying to do is to gradually learn not to be compelled by physical realities. Now, Swami also says that sensuality is not just defined by what you do or don't do, it's the attitude with which you do it. And he has an extremely excellent discussion of sexuality specifically in the Raja Yoga book. But what he's talking about is that which draws energy back to yourself selfishly versus that energy which is self-giving. And the thing about sensuality is that it tends to be driven by desire. And that desire tends to be, I want, I need, I have to have. And so we can suppress that desire. I refuse to indulge that desire, but that doesn't necessarily transform that desire. And he also talks about this, it's a very subtle point, you know, we think that when we feel tension inside, I want that cookie, I have a sexual desire that needs to be fulfilled, that the best way to do it is to indulge it. And he says there is a release of tension. He said, but that release of tension is not always upward moving energy. But The release of tension can be mitigated by the selfish or selfless way in which it's expressed. And so when he's entering the whole realm of sexuality, that's the point at which you find balance. You know, am I just constantly indulging my own impulse and releasing my own desires, or am I actually using this energy in a way that builds something that has a higher dimension to it? And it's the desire for, as he puts it, release of tension is also in itself somewhat of a desire for unconsciousness. You know, people overeat to the point of unconsciousness, or they'll watch television to the point of unconsciousness, or indulge in sexuality, or drink to the point of unconsciousness. And that's what makes it bad. Because of the direction of the energy, as Swamiji said, bad in the sense of not happiness producing. He said, because there's nothing in creation. God made the whole story. So it's not like anything is inherently evil. And that this, it just gets, this is where religion makes such a mess out of spirituality. There is a divine law that if you just continually expend energy rather than conserve and direct it, you'll end up drained. Just as simple as that. But if instead you think consciously about how your energy is being used, and then use it as in as truthful a manner as you can, in terms of who you are and what you're able to do, then everything gradually moves in the right direction, and you develop tremendous power. And you know, interestingly, many of the great geniuses of history did not marry and were celibate, because that same energy that's pushing for expression, if instead of indulging it, it is gathered and directed upward, which you see, that's the whole point. It has to be gathered and directed upward. That's the difference between transmutation and suppression. That's what he said once. The ideal practice of celibacy makes you lighter and lighter, he said, but too often it just makes people tighter and tighter. And that about sums it up. You know, you see, unfortunately, you know, many people who even taken up a religious life but haven't correspondingly gathered that energy and expressed it upward, and all that happens is they're trapped. But this applies to more than just sexuality. It's just, what do we do with our energy? Are we constantly just letting it drain out? Are we aware of how we're using it? And this goes back to covetousness. Am I constantly feeling this tension inside myself, and just, I'll go buy something new. I want more. I want more company. I want more stimulation. I want more things. I want more this. Or are we holding that energy in? That's what brahmacharya is, to hold the energy in and using it in an upward moving direction. Swami remarks, you know, that many people who are very dedicated to becoming an Olympic athlete or to becoming a good painter or a writer or a singer, other people will think, oh, you're missing out on so much, because you're always doing this. Well, they don't feel that way, because what they recognize they're doing is that they're disciplining and gathering all that energy for a much greater fulfillment than just the constant release of tension. And that's what we're talking about with brahmacharya, flowing with Brahma. Okay. And what happens when the ideal practice of this is that you have tremendous vigor and tremendous power. Just tremendous. That's why so many geniuses also end up being celibate, because you have a lot of you collect inside yourself all this great force, because you're not dissipating it all the time. I'm looking for some of the book. Let me just see it for a second. Yes, that's what I thought. So the perfect practice of this also is that everything you need comes to you without effort, because once you're no longer disturbing the divine flow, but are standing in it, then it flows through you in the right way. So our anxiety that's moving us all the time, the anxiety itself separates us, because it's not truthful. We're doing violence to our own nature, our own true nature. But when we align ourselves, then everything that we need comes to us. I know a friend of mine, it's just like, she stood and I just sort of said, why? God has always provided for me. Why do I think he would stop? This is such an interesting way to think of it. He doesn't always provide effortlessly and so on, but why do I think he would stop? You ask yourself that question. All right, now the last here, non-acceptance. And this is one, this is just so subtle and such fun. Because, again, well, if I'm not me, then who am I? If this is just a temporary identity, what would it be like, really, not to define myself by everything which looks so obvious to me? My talents, my gender, my culture, my people, my job, whatever it might be. What if these are just realities I'm moving through? And what would it feel like to move through them with that completely other attitude? Swami Kriyananda said about himself a long time ago, he said, I've never identified with Kriyananda, is how he puts it. Kriyananda is merely an event for which I am responsible. He was conscious that he was responsible for him and everything he did, and he responded very consciously and appropriately given his responsibility. But it was never him. He even remarked toward the end of his life, which I loved, he said, the older I get, he said, the more the myth of Kriyananda, he says, I feel it swirling around me. That's how he put it. He said, but inside, I'm the same old fellow. He was just Master's chela, really. The only thing he accepted was Master's unconditional love and his love for Master. And the rest of it he participated in with great awareness, but he never allowed himself to accept that that was really who he was. And it's so much fun to deal with that. You know, then things happen to this unit of consciousness that have to be dealt with, and sometimes they're painful and sometimes they're joyful. See, the thing about Swamiji, because he didn't really accept any of it as his self-definition, he actually was able to experience much more completely, because he wasn't always protecting something. And so he's very tender-hearted, and it wasn't that he didn't experience pain or suffering or disappointment. He experienced it all in many ways much more sensitively than those of us who are always protecting some self-definition. But he wasn't compelled by it. And you know, that's where it all comes to. It's all a question of what creates happiness, what creates suffering. And what we're really looking for is freedom. The freedom to choose and have our own consciousness. And if we define ourselves too much by this transitory reality, then just by definition our freedom is gone, isn't it? Do we need another break, or should I just go for half an hour with that? Okay. So, I'll take a few questions, but then I have to go through the meetings. So, do we have any questions about this, or do we have the questions? But you can see how a mother and her children would have such fun.
I have a question in what you just said last. You said they experience them all.
Yes.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
This is something
that... Because it's not about pushing them away.
No, it's not about pushing them away, because sorrow, disappointment, betrayal, the beauty of friendship, divine love, nature, art, it's all there. It's all made by God. And we sometimes imagine that the way to be non-attached or not defined by it is that we block it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that somehow we hold ourselves a little separate from the stream of life, aloof. It's taken me a long time to understand that aloof is not the same as non-attached. Because aloof, in my observation and experience, is based on fear of being hurt. And fear of being hurt is not the same as freedom. Because everything is God's reality. Everything is your own karma. Why would I covet an experience that wasn't mine? I want everyone to be loyal to me. I want everyone to be nice to me. They're not being nice to me. I covet another experience. So I will protect myself. I won't experience this. I'll protect myself from it by pretending a certain non-attachment. But that's fear that's motivating me, you see. So what I saw in Swamiji was he had no reason to be untruthful. So-and-so betrayed him on a colossal scale. And it was very painful to have sincere love returned in that way. It was very painful to see another soul doing something that was going to create misery for that soul. You can't just say there's no pain involved in that. And you can't just hold yourself aloof from that, because that's not quite true. One of my friends tried to ease her own broken heart by saying, oh, everything was just as it was meant to be. Swami's response was saying, no, he behaved very badly. That's what Swami said. Don't comfort yourself with a lie. Mm-hmm. He said, you have to see it for exactly what it was, and then you have to transcend it. Quite different. So because he never accepted anything about Kriyananda as defining him, he could have the experience of being Kriyananda completely, which included, in this particular case, a lot of really hard karma, a lot of mistreatment from others, a lot of real unkindness, a lot of disappointment, and people not responding in the way he had hoped, many, many things. But he wasn't afraid of any of them, and he didn't hold himself aloof from any of it. You hold yourself aloof if you're identified with it. That's not non-attachment. I mean, you hold yourself aloof on very subtle levels. You hold yourself aloof from your own past life suffering. You just don't want to know how broken your heart is, because you still identify with it and you still kind of another experience. This is self-realization is not for sissies. That's why there are so few of us. But this is ultimate freedom we're talking about. This is not a band-aid. This is not, oh, I'll feel better for a while. This is, even if I can't get there, if I don't lie to myself about what I must do eventually, this is what I'm saying about the children. You don't just dress them up like tomatoes and laugh at them so they're mortified when they grow up. You teach them from a young age that which is really true on their own level and in their own way, so that it'll grow with them. So that's what we have to do. But part of truthfulness is to realize, I'm not there yet. This was Dave and Jyotish when they were trying to persuade their young son to be very generous to the bully. You know, he's just having trouble. You can just be nice to him. And apparently what he's heard, I just heard Davey say it. He said, I don't want to be that kind of person. That sounds good, but that's not going to be me. I'm perfectly honest. That's not trying to wish away. That's not even coveting something you're not. It's recognizing that eventually, but not today. I mean, I have that conversation with God a lot. I know I'm going to accept. The Swami said to me once when I was disputing something, he said, Asha, you're going to agree with me in the end. Just be quiet and think about it. It was his, he became impatient with me at that point as I was hassling him. So, okay, Lord, I'm going to agree with this in the end, but I'm not enjoying it yet. But you're not even coveting for your own self a state of consciousness that you don't have yet. Okay, are we content? Yes.
One question. Mm-hmm. I feel like if, let's say, I was in a grocery store and someone was unkind to me completely because of their delusion, it's easy for me to sit and meditate and send love to them and be done with that. But when it's someone who's very close to me in my home being unkind out of their own whatever delusion is happening in their life, then trying to change that situation is not coveting, because...
Well, maybe it is, because every unkindness that's delivered to you is because you yourself delivered an unkindness at some point. Mm-hmm. You might not be delivering it today, but you delivered it yesterday. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it wouldn't be able to penetrate your aura. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's not for sisters.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean that very seriously. It's the hardest thing in the world to understand. And of course, why would you go to the gym and just put 1 pound on the machine every time you go and just run through the motions of lifting the weights? You know, the weights have to be increased. So yeah, sure, you're great. It's really easy to be nice to strangers. So, but fabulous, but you give birth to a child who's an old enemy. You know, these things happen. My mother, I heard, she had twins. One was an old friend, one was an old enemy. That was a long and very interesting story.
So how do I practice the yamas there when I have knowingly, unknowingly caused harm and that harm is coming back to me?
With great difficulty. And as a constant moment-by-moment practice that takes absolutely everything you have. But the only comfort is, what is your alternative? I mean, when I get karma that I don't like, it's like, and believe me, I'm not, you know, I'm in the same rowboat that you're in, that's why I can talk about this. You know, the desire to do harm in a thousand ways is there. And the only thing that saves me, not from wrong action and wrong thought, I make a distinction in my mind between those actions and attitudes that I commit and those that I am committed to. Okay? I may have a very wrong attitude in lots of ways, but I recognize it as a wrong attitude. And so I'm not committed to it. I'm committing it, but I'm not committed to it. So here I am, out of control, with the full knowledge that this is not really going to help me, but that is what it's called true, but not in the moment relevant advice. It's like, I'm going to go down this path until I can get a hold of myself. And the whole spiritual path is day after day after day after day of failure and success and failure and success. And I've been teaching for 40 years, and I've been in quite a few countries, and I get the same question, I realize, with many different accents and many different orientations, and the question is this, no matter how it's presented. Is there an easier way? Can you tell me the shortcut? Not that I know. And that's why there aren't very many self-realizations in the world.
Yes. I'd like to share regarding that something that really helps me, in case it resonates with someone. So I know when something sticks to me, it's because it's mine. So whenever I have an experience like that, I just say, something that I did somehow brought this to my life.
Yes.
And I just ask for her forgiveness for whatever I have done that created that.
And it helps.
And I have peace right away.
Do you ask forgiveness from the person or from yourself? From the divine?
My higher self, God, whatever works for you, because you did it to yourself. And then I ask for that energy to be transmuted within me, because that's my karma.
That's the right attitude. No,
that's what works.
Balance. No, it does work. It's a wonderful way to respond. The other part of it is, part of truthfulness and non-covetousness is to say, I'm not strong enough to deal with this. I'm going to lose every single time. I need to exercise some power here and put myself where I have a chance. Because this is not just hang out there and just keep trying to have the right attitude while you get absolutely pulverized and become mincemeat, and your attitude is 100 times worse because you're just so far beyond yourself.
That's the brick wall again.
That's the brick wall. So I just need to stay here because I have to learn, No, at a certain point, I was asked this last time I was here. At what point do you change circumstances, and at what point do you say that I'm supposed to learn this? Swami said to me, you've taken this as far as you can take it. You need to just put this on the shelf and go over there for now. And it was in just that circumstance. You can't handle this. So just go over there and do something you can do. And then you'll get stronger. And then he said quite definitely, don't worry, it'll come back. You'll get to see it. You're not really saying, I'm never going to deal with this. You're just saying, honestly, I can't.
Well, that's that truthfulness again, isn't it?
Truthfulness. You see how it all comes out? You're not being truthful then, and you're coveting a state of consciousness you don't have, which is the ability to live according to these ideals.
The part about the non-lying and the truthfulness that stood out with the
with what Selima asked, is having the mindset that there's a circumstance outside of us that we can change.
Yes, exactly.
And when we get to the point of just accepting it is for whatever it is, and, you know, coming back to the truthfulness that we believe in, then, you know, it seems like that will be the right path to take. It is recognizing that there is something that we really think could be changed.
And you have to say, even if you don't understand it, you see, it's very subtle, because often people are behaving abominably. That's like what my friend, you can't make it okay by just saying, oh, it was all fine. No, in fact, this person is being a selfish twit. You know? However, they are being a selfish twit, and I can't handle it. I mean, so it's subtle. What I meant by that, by subtle, is sometimes you are right, but it doesn't mean it's any less your karma. See, that's the annoying part. You are right.
Can I tell the selfish twit you're being a selfish twit nicely?
I know you're joking, but... this is precisely what happened between me and that man. Mm-hmm. It was not helpful. Mm-hmm. It was not beneficial to tell that person the blunt truth. It didn't help them a whit. Tell them the blunt truth. Mm-hmm. And it was selfish on my part, because it made me feel better. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking only of myself. Didn't help the person at all. Just infuriated me. Yeah.
In a 12-step program, I'd refer to that as taking somebody else's inventory.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes you feel better, because look at me, I can tell you that you're wrong. But it's not beneficial. This is not for sissies. Mm-hmm. So then you have to, but it won't change circumstances. It's very, I mean, person really wants to know, that's entirely different, but they rarely do. Especially not from when they're...
I was going to say something along the same lines, especially because it's somebody who's close to you and you are involved in the mess yourself. You do give a statement of truth might be really reinforcing sometimes your own delusions, and sometimes you add, instead of actually withdrawing from that energy, you're actually adding fuel to it. So sometimes not saying anything might be the most beneficial thing, and working on yourself in a way that you don't add energy to that mess, because sometimes you feel like saying more, doing more is going to resolve the thing, but
yes, you know.
Yeah, and you don't have the perspective to judge, especially in a relationship or in an equation where things are at some tension.
At the boiling point.
And you might be saying the absolute truth, but coming from you is not going to go into the other person's
consciousness. And you're doing it out of covetousness. You see, this is where all of these things really go together. You're doing it out of covetousness, and often out of a desire to inflict harm. It's just the way it is. And now, there are times when truthfulness does demand. You are the most inseparable beast I have ever seen. I put all your belongings in a black garbage bag and you will find them on the porch. I mean, sometimes, that's right. Because there are times, it's not simple, it's an art. You have to just really look at it, you know, because it is, what is the movement for me? But that doesn't mean that you didn't deserve that inseparable person, but maybe the whole karma of that one is, I too have value. And that might be what the whole thing is leading to. There's no rules.
But the difference there is, it's about me correcting my behavior rather than saying
that
you are...
Yeah. That's exactly right. But you might still behave in such a way that would look the same as something else. So this is why this is all vibrations. Mm-hmm. So I want to at least, you know, get the yamas on the board. The neons on the board. But the good news is, this is all in Swami's book, so beautiful, in his two books. But nonetheless, of course, the discussion is worthwhile. That's why we're here. Okay.
You can come back again.
I'm around.
I'm just struck by how profound these teachings are. They sound so simple in the beginning, but they are so profound in how they fit together and what they mean for us if we're really working on awareness.
You know, I love this. When I walked into this all those years ago, I didn't know this. I didn't know if it would last forever. But it lasts forever. And I have to be a little chauvinistic here. Paramahansa Yogananda, Swami Kriyananda, they are so brilliant in the way they have articulated this. And I mean, I'm sure there's many other good paths, I just don't study them. But this one, I mean, all these years, and I really have to say this honestly, I have never been asked or asked a question that didn't have an answer. You know, sometimes you have to think a little bit and try to find it, but there's always an answer because it goes all the way through. Even this whole discussion here, you know, where and what and who, it's all just right there. It's right out of Patanjali as it's been explained to us. Mm-hmm. And I've never found a question that didn't have a solution. Except how long does it take if your consciousness is in a diamond to get out of being a diamond? But that's just, those are details. All right, the niyamas, I mean. These are the things that you let run free. The first one is called cleanliness, which is sort of a funny one, cleanliness being next to godliness, but it actually means purity. Okay. The second is contentment, which I hit a little bit because it's the pair to non-covetousness. And austerity, tapasya, which is the nice Indian word which I love. When we were song, they give us Indian names in the early years. You could ask me for a name and give me a name. We're always afraid that he might name There is actually a woman I know not named by Swami, it's called Tapasya. I think, whoa. But I learned to enjoy the name more. Self-study. And the fifth is devotion to the Supreme Lord. Because we don't have as much time here, it's like, you know, they all follow naturally. The concept of cleanliness, which is really better as purity. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. That's what Jesus said. And all the other qualities that Jesus talked about, you know, if you mourn, you'll be comforted. He has these, but purity of heart goes to seeing God. Because purity is an interesting word. Swami in his book talks about it this way. If you're outside, when this man named Hanno Cassidy was training our gardeners, he trained them to use the word soil and not to use the word dirt. Mm-hmm. Dirt is kind of a popular word now. But he never wanted them to call it dirt. He said, if you bring it in the house, it's dirt. But when it's outside growing the crops, it's soil. And you were never allowed to talk about the dirt. You could only talk about the soil. And so when we're talking about purity, and this has to do, again, with the way religion gets organized, is that there's nothing inherently dark or dirty about God's creation. How could there be? Everything is a manifestation of the divine. You know, sexuality, evil, you know, evil actions, none of it. It's just in the wrong place. You know, the tiger has to kill to eat. But when the human being who doesn't need to eat is killing, then all of a sudden that impulse to kill is in the wrong place. So it becomes impure because of that. But when we can get rid of all the impurities, which is if we can remove from our consciousness everything that isn't inherently ours, we see God. Because it's all the lying, the non-truthfulness, the covetousness. And he balances these. Let me just see, let's see. Ah, yes, the purity of heart is balanced with non-violence. He pairs them, I mean. He pairs them. Because if we have an attitude of absolute harmlessness toward everything in creation, including ourselves, that puts us into a state of purity of heart. Isn't that sweet? And when we are absolutely pure of heart, he said also, we have a complete freedom from the compulsions of the body. And we have what is beautifully called a disinclination to indulge in the senses. I love that word, disinclination. That's so nonviolent. It's not even disciplined. It's just that I'm not inclined to do it anymore. when I have removed from my consciousness everything that doesn't belong there, I'm just not inclined to want to indulge this body anymore. I mean, even think of it in terms of being a vegetarian or not wanting to drink or not wanting to be promiscuous. You get closer to your own nature, you're just disinclined to those things. There's no, you don't have to get up every morning and not want to do it. It's just, you're not inclined to because it makes you feel polluted rather than uplifted. Because you have, by you practice, you've allowed your natural purity to express itself. In our schools with our children, we try our very best to keep them younger. You know, do you remember there used to be like children's clothes? Remember children's mm-hmm. clothes? Now you see 3-year-olds dressed in sexually provocative outfits. They're dressed just exactly like their parents. Everybody thinks it's so cute. But we've just completely brought all the way down into childhood all of the confusion and acquisitiveness. And one of my Indian friends, now India's getting to be just like America, but one of my Indian friends came to this country and he had his children, and he said to me, he said, "I'm just so amazed." He said, "Every child in America has an entire room of their own which is filled with things that belong to the child." I mean, just the way he said it was like, what does a child need with a whole room full of material objects that they get to sit around and call mine? How early all that corruption comes in. And everybody just thinks it's cute, but it's not cute at all. We're not allowing the sort of natural purity of the spirit, even in childhood, to have a few years of its own freedom. So, and contentment, the opposite of contentment is non-avarice, as we've talked about. When you no longer covet anything that isn't yours, then our natural contentment will just express itself, won't it? And again, these are very important nuances to understand. Our natural state is to feel God's presence around us and say, "What else do I need?" There was a story told supposedly about, I think it was Diogenes, some great, I think it was he, but it was some great wise man of the past. And someone came and offered him, you know, a kingdom and all of these things. And, "Thank you, I don't need any of it." He said, "Well, is there anything you do need?" He said, "Yes." He said, "If you move a little to the left, you're blocking the sun." Just like, but think about that. And so think about being in a position in yourself. It's very fabulous meditation. To just try in your meditation to still every oscillating impulse that's drawing you away from feeling absolutely at peace where you're sitting. And see, that's the opposite side of reaching out, is that when I stop reaching out, what automatically happens is that I settle into contentment. That is my natural state. I just have to control the impulse to reach outside from it. Austerity, tapasya, is, I mean, I've heard other definitions of this. Patience is a marvelous one. And let me just think with the verse here. Because we call it austerity, that implies that we're denying ourselves something. And the pair to this is brahmacharya, which is if we control the impulse to dissipate our energy, then what we have is we have great devotion, is also another explanation here. But we have devotion to a higher idea. And this is where austerity and devotion to the Supreme Lord really have to go together. Because when we discipline ourselves to a high ideal, and in that discipline we realize that ideal, where is the loss? And that's why both patience and devotion, I love devotion the most. Devotion is not an absolute definition, but it's part of it. Tapasya is to discipline the lesser impulse for the sake of the greater satisfaction.
Can you say that again?
To discipline the lesser impulse for the sake of the greater satisfaction. I want a gold medal in the Olympics. I'm not going to go out carousing with my friends every night. I want to be a great artist. I'm not going to take a vacation this summer. I'm just going to stay home. I want to really learn to meditate. I'm not going to go to the south of France. I'm going to go to Rwanda Village for my 2 weeks off this year. Where it may look like you're losing, but you're actually focusing yourself toward a higher goal. And there has to be a higher goal in there, devotion to the Supreme Lord. But then, where is the loss? There's a joke, supposedly a joke, or actually a true exchange between, I don't know who he was, but he was a world-class violinist. And after a concert, a fan came up to him and said, I'd give my life to be able to play the violin like that. And the man just said, I have. Mm-hmm. And that was just his answer. Yes, I can play the violin like this because I have given my life to this. And the implication was, and yes, it was worth it. So that's how we have to think of austerity. It's not really austerity. But see, this isn't don't control it, meaning all this self-indulgence is not natural to us. What's really natural to us is a disinclination for the things of the body, because the body is very, very temporary. And everybody thinks that the pleasures it gives us are the greatest pleasures there are, but what happens is we get old, it gets broken, and eventually it dies. And if we've been clinging to all of that, you know, just clinging to youth and sensuality and sexuality and attractiveness and money, and then we lose it, what happens to us? Where is the joy in that? But if we can control the inclination to dissipate our energy, we will discover this tremendous energy builds up within us. And the result of the proper practice of tapasya is that we develop supernatural powers. Cities, powers. Because if our energy is not being dissipated, we suddenly can work miracles. Because we become in tune with that actual side of ourselves. Self-study, and this is the same as non-acceptance. And this is the perfect practice of this, is that we discover past lives. That's what happens if we don't identify with our present reality. The result of self-study also is that they say you can commune with higher beings. We begin to realize who and what we really are, and our reality connects with the greater reality. Devotion to the Supreme Lord is very sweetly put, and Swami explains this really beautifully, and this is the same as non-lying. Because if we are genuinely truthful, we recognize that we are part of a greater reality. In our Festival of Light, we are celebrating that we are part of all that is. It comes in over and over again. You are part of all that is. When I was thinking about the most effective way to communicate what we're talking about is that we are part of a greater reality. And the dividing line again between self-realizationists and everybody else on the planet is, do you recognize that you are part of a greater reality? Or do you think that you're just operating all by yourself in your ego? What's the tragedy of our world is that people no longer remember that they're part of a greater reality. If I can get it for myself, then that's good. And not realizing that if I'm wrecking the economy of the planet by doing so, it's not going to bring me what I really want. And Swami also writes very beautifully about basically why not call it God. Why rebel so hard? But what he's really saying is you have to have an ideal image toward which you are aspiring. If what you are is everything and I'm just my own God, then why put out any effort? Why you have no direction? You just go endlessly in circles. There has to be some concept of that ideal. And this one says, why not call that God? It's bigger than what we know, whatever you, whatever it means to you. And we have to become devoted to that reality. And that's non-life. That's really seeing the truth of my life is that it's directional and there is a place that I'm going, and that's a conscious force. And it's the comforter. It's bliss, whatever you want to, whatever words you add to the word God. But that devotion then makes austerity valuable. That devotion is when you self-study, you become aware, you realize that you're content because you're in relationship to it. You realize it's your true nature. So everything resolves here. If we stop if we let run free our natural devotion to a higher reality. Children already know this. When we talk about our school, we say, you know, we don't really teach them spirituality. We just confirm what they already know. Whereas what happens to them so much is that the so-called educational system gradually takes away from them their intuitive understanding of a divine reality realm. And what we do in our school is we cultivate that and confirm it. We confirm their own intuitive understanding instead of contradicting it to the point where they themselves lose faith in it. Devotion to the Supreme Lord. Okay. That's the whole story.
Beautiful.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Amazing. So we're going to be taking our lunch break. It seems like it's going to be right back.
Yeah.
Oh, Red looks good.
Yeah.
We're supporting a good, good thing.
Yeah. Is Asha going to be speaking anymore today?
Not for us.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Has another group that she is.
I
don't know.
Yeah.
She's
okay.
Not with our
group. I was just wondering about recording, but I don't. Mm. So I can put this away.
Mm. What is this? I should stop it. How do I stop it?